8:13 now. Good morning. Well, the Summit County Council meeting tomorrow at the Sheldon Richens Building, beginning with a celebration of the solar panel installation there. In the studio with a look at the rest of the agenda, I have County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this little celebration taking place at 3 Rocky Mountain Power, what, handing Summit County a check for the installation?
A big old check. So the total project costs of putting about 107-kilowatt solar array on the Richens building is about $220,000. We'll get $100,000 from the Blue Sky program for Rocky Mountain Power to offset that cost, so quite a significant contribution to that project.
Yeah, any idea how many panels we installed to get that one?
I don't know how many panels it is. If you go out and look at it, it's a lot. What I do know is that it will end up providing about 40 to 45% of the power for that building. So quite a significant contribution. At the same time, we did a lighting retrofit inside the building recently, changing from whatever was in there to LED lighting, which also reduces that power load. So quite a significant change to the Richens building.
Yeah. Plans for installation anywhere else?
We don't have any plans in 2019 to do any installations. I think we still have a project ongoing with the Camas building to finish that up and get the solar panels on it. I'll get you some more information on that as I learn more.
Okay. The council goes into closed session right after that celebration, and then we'll reopen with a work session at about 4:45 to discuss the county's letter to the state auditor. Apparently, the state auditor's office over the past year conducted a fraud risk assessment for all counties. Counties were asked to fill out a questionnaire, and then you had an auditor visit last month. The staff report says that the assessment shows that our fraud risk level is very low. Just why should we rely on the county assessing itself?
Well, I mean, it doesn't always assess itself. In this case, the state auditor provided a tool called the fraud risk questionnaire and had been working with counties to go through that. And instead of waiting for the state to come out and report on all counties, we wanted to put out our own assessment of that. And what it shows us is it matches our independent audits that we do each year. For the past 3 years, we have, with our independent audit, have been at a risk level of very low, which is also reported when we do all of our federal grant work for the county.
So what risk are we at low for?
Well, it's basically risk for something negative happening or fraud happening against the county. So there's a lot of checks and balances within county government and municipal government when it comes to dealing with the money that we deal with, the taxes of the taxpayers. So for instance, when payroll is done each week, the treasurer signs the payroll report, I sign the payroll report, and the auditor prepares it. So there's three different entities looking at that before it goes out.
You get paid every week?
I'm sorry, every 2 weeks.
I was going to say, who gets paid every week anymore? Let's see. A discussion then that a group of county employees, up to 10, would be trained as reserve wildland firefighters. What's being proposed here is actually a policy. So we're talking about giving them training. And
well, it has to sit in our personnel policies because we would have to train them in order to do that. The issue has come up over the last couple of years that especially our volunteer fire districts in the South Summit area and North Summit area don't always have the immediate availability of folks to help with especially wildfire. So this, if the council agrees with it, will provide some availability of county employees to do that. And it's supposed to be, you know, kind of an emergency situation. So sometime that the North Summit Fire District, for instance, would not have the capacity right away. If these county employees are used on a wildfire, they'd also be the first pulled off. So when those wildfire teams come in from state or national level, our employees would come back and be back on the county job.
So what kind of training would they get?
The same kind of for the colloquialism of red card training that that wildland firefighters get. So everything else the same kind of equipment that those that are trained with North Summit Fire or South Summit Fire would have.
So then what triggers when they can leave their regular county job to go fight fires?
First of all, they have to be approved to be part of this program by their supervisor. So there'll be some discussion between our personnel department and that department beforehand, even to make sure they're eligible. But if they're called by the fire district to do that, they can leave the job, depending on what they're doing. I mean, if they're doing something critical to county operations at that point, we'll have to make a decision.
Okay. But who makes that decision, you or the agent?
I will be making that decision.
Okay. All right. And will they get additional pay?
They'll be paid the same as they're paid right now. It's just they're volunteering to be part of that program.
Okay. So they can leave their job to go fight fires, but wouldn't be getting any additional compensation?
I don't believe so.
Okay. And again, is this just for North Summit, or are we going to...
It's really available to all our fire districts in the county, but the most likely uses of that would be in North Summit and South Summit.
Sure. Then at 6:30 p.m., a joint meeting with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission to discuss work tasks and deadlines for 2019. There was no staff report on this. Can you tell us what some of those tasks
are? Sure. They're doing a lot of code amendments at this time or updates to the code that are being considered. They're going to be relooking at the general plan this year. They're doing their annual look at that. One of the big tasks coming is processing the Kimball Junction neighborhood plan that's making its way to the Planning Commission right now. So they're going to be discussing those and other items that might be on either the Planning Commission's mind or the Council's mind to make sure that they have some agreement on when those are going to kind of flow from the Planning Commission to the Council during the year and set some deadlines for that.
All right. The Kimball Junction neighborhood plan, is this new or are we revising it?
It doesn't exist right now, so this would be the Planning Commission's first look at it. We've had a task force looking at that and coming up with the draft for about a year, a little bit over a year.
This Blue Ribbon Commission.
That's correct. They made their recommendation or drafted their final recommendation in December. So it's making its way to the Planning Commission.
All right. And then in terms of deadlines, what are we looking at for the coming year?
I think sometimes there's not discussion before these items come up about when the council would like to see them. So sometimes they get mixed up in other business of the Planning Commission. So I think they're just trying to have a discussion about when those things should come forward.
Yeah, I think the only TZO we have is on the scooters, right?
That's correct. That's the only one we know of right now. Who knows what will come up in the near future?
Okay. Do you think you're on the same page as the planners?
I haven't heard a lot about that one in the recent past. I'm going to be going to a staff meeting today, and I can ask some questions about that. I think generally we're on the same page. When it was brought forward to the council first, they gave some good advice to the planners on how to proceed. A lot of information just continues to come out about what best practices are out there in the country and around the world, and we're keeping track of those as we move forward.
Yeah. That's about it for the agenda, but did want to ask you a little bit about an update with regard to the safe crossing somewhere across 224. We saw another traffic accident, and that brought up, even though the pedestrian crossing really has nothing to do with cars, you know, just brought up the fact that where are we with that crossing?
So we've been waiting for the active transportation planning effort that has been going on for about the past year. I saw a preliminary draft of that in my email just in the last week. So I think the different staff groups, whether they be UDOT, whether they be ourselves, Park City, the other municipalities, and interest groups are probably reviewing that right now. It should be coming out for some public scrutiny in the near future, as well as some elected official reporting. And it does have some information in it about safe crossing. So I'm sure that'll be a big discussion.
So did you get a peek at the location that they're talking about?
I got a peek at several locations, but I'm not going to talk specifically about it because I don't want to get in front of the plan.
Okay. So when does this get brought forth?
I'm going to have to say that probably within this quarter. So I think that's the best, most specific I can be.
All right. The Salt Lake Tribune published a long list of delinquent taxpayers. How much of an issue is this for Summit County when tens, hundreds, thousands of dollars aren't paid?
Yeah, I think the if you want to get the most specific information about that, it would be good for you to talk to Corey Forsling, the county treasurer. You know, as I've looked at that process happen over the last 4 years, delinquency doesn't seem to be a big issue in Summit County. I have not seen any big delinquencies happen. Certainly, we've passed the deadline for 2018 taxes to be paid. I'm sure the treasurer's office has that specific information if you'd like it.
Yeah, is it fair to say that for some of these larger property owners, they just see the 1.5% interest charge as kind of a low interest loan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a possibility. I think most people want to pay their taxes and get it in on time. Even 1.5% hits a bottom line, whether it's a personal or a business. But you know, those are decisions that those taxpayers need to make. And of course, there is a further process beyond that to collect those taxes if they go delinquent for longer periods of time.
Yeah. I mean, for those who habitually do this, I mean, should we consider higher penalties or you can't do that because it's a state
law? Yeah, it's a state law. Mm-hmm. We're governed by that. I'm sure that's something that the Treasurers Association discusses each year as part of their preparation for the legislative session. So we'll stay tuned as that kicks off towards the end of this month to see if anything changes.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
We got a bunch of volunteer opportunities coming up, and I'll just run through them quick. And if you're interested, get a hold of us at Summit County and get the specifics. Timberline Special Service District, Mountain Regional Water Special Service District, Park City Fire Service District, South Summit Cemetery Maintenance District, Summit County Restaurant Tax Advisory Committee, and Service Area 5, which is Lake Rockport Estates, all have board openings. So get in there and show your interest.
Okay. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. This is the Local News Hour on KBCW. Local News Hour. The Park City Planning Commission meets for the first time of 2019 tomorrow in the studio with a preview, Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So not a real big agenda, but there was one item, a request to amend Lot 38 in Westridge that would basically adjust the open space line. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so in the latter days of the Park Meadows master plan development approvals, the Planning Commission was really careful to protect all the remaining open space as part of the PUD and restrict building sizes and building locations. The subdivision was platted that way with some restrictions as protected open space in the back of those lots, and those lot lines were platted. In this particular case, during the construction of the building, the area of open space was built on with plazas and decks and a hot tub and some walls. And so we started some enforcement action on that, and in order to cure this, the applicant is asking to modify the open space line in order to accommodate what they're asking for. The staff's recommendation is denial because it doesn't seem to us to be consistent with the strategy, which is the original master plan asked for this stuff to be open space and wildlife habitat. Second, it's not consistent with the value system in the general plan to reduce the intrusion of the built environment into the natural environment. And so part of the good cause for this subdivision, when it was approved, was that this was all going to be protected open space. The applicant has a different opinion, which is great. We're going to let the Planning Commission sort it out. But currently we're in discussions with them.
So was this a lot or was this a redo?
No, this is a lot. This is a lot. It was platted. Mm-hmm. They bought the lot with this restriction on it. The protective covenants are fairly clear that this is protected open space, but for whatever reason, all of a sudden these things got built.
So will they have to pull it out if you don't amend it?
Yes.
Hmm. Is this where title insurance kicks in?
I don't know the answer to that one. I don't necessarily have all the evidence of how this got built, and built inside or outside of the building permit action and the grading permits and all the other stuff we issue. It's just we identified an incursion into this open space, and the CC&Rs prohibit this kind of an incursion, so the neighbors are not particularly thrilled either.
So does the city have any liability in this?
No.
I mean, you approved the...
We did not approve these decks, and we did approve the limits of disturbance, which is different than the platted open space question.
Okay. Hey, let's look ahead. That's pretty much it for tomorrow's agenda, but let's look ahead. You've got a work session scheduled for the January 23rd meeting. After hearing from Park City Museum Director Sandra Morrison last month about the details of the Flagstaff Annexation Agreement that outlines funding for historic preservation, the Planning Commission is going to have a look at what that approved and what everyone seems to have forgotten about?
Well, I don't know that we've forgotten. And I appreciate Sandra's work, and I also appreciate the Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History work on all of these things. So we've had to do a real in-depth set of research in order to get this work session back going and seeing exactly what happened and why things happened. So at any rate, the simple answer is there are roughly 22 sites that are part of the Flagstaff technical report number 6. 19 of them, plus or minus, depending on how you interpret some of the information, have been remediated according to the development agreement. What seems to be lacking is at the time when we were going through all of this, neither side understood a couple of things. One was, how does this ongoing funding mechanism work? And who's responsible when the developer goes away? So in the case of Park City Mountain, for example, the operator owns the permits, and we can hold them responsible. In the case of Empire Pass and Flagstaff, ultimately when all that property is sold, that master developer goes away, and so the tricky bit is who's responsible for this development agreement and the ongoing maintenance of these sites and the ongoing funding. So we're in negotiations right now with Redis, which is the current successor to Wells Fargo, and with Story Development, which is the end developer on these two sites, to talk about how these mechanisms will work in the future. We've also drilled all the way back down into the 1999, 1997, 2001, 2004, and 2007 development agreement approvals and trying to make a determination how all of the agencies, including the Planning Commission, determined that they were in compliance when, in fact, something like the Judge site wasn't necessarily in compliance with the original model. And the museum is correct. The developer at the time had committed to do an adapted reuse for the Judge site. That didn't happen. The planning staff and the Planning Commission did not change the technical report to accommodate that. There's some weak spots in there.
Yeah. So apparently this also lays out this 1% transfer tax. Basically, for all of the property that was sold, 1% was collected.
Right.
Who's collecting it and where does that money go?
Okay, so to be clear, it's a transfer fee. It's not a tax because we can't do that in the state of Utah. And that fee goes 50% to the Master Owners Association to fund open space and transit, and the other half comes to the city to fund open space and transit. And that money resides in the budget office, and Nate Rockwood, who's our budget and finance officer, knows where all of that money is, and we've had a chance to look, and yeah, it's there. It gets spent almost all in transit and open space. One of the things that's been ongoing for the last period of time, whatever that is, 5 or 10 years, is the phrase in the development agreement says open space preservation. And so if you put a comma between open space and preservation, then some of that money should be flowing to historic preservation. It's our opinion, and it has been consistent for that whole period of time, that that's for open space and maintaining trails and doing forest management and all the other stuff, weed management and all those other things are supposed to do. It's not supposed to be funding historic preservation. And so that's one of the negotiations with Redis and Storied is you've got some commitments in these technical reports. How do you propose to fund them when the ultimate owner goes away?
So do we know how much money's been collected?
I don't know that number. It's a big number. And it gets spent annually coming out of the budget office. We will try and have that number ready for the 23rd, at least in the annual report.
Okay. Star Hotel, this is scheduled to be demolished. Has it happened?
No. They're right now in some very technical interior exploratory demolition. Planner Gron and Planner Tyler, along with the rest of my staff, have been in that building a couple times over the last week. They're trying to make a detailed determination on how they want the rock foundation restored and how do you mark those rocks so that they can be restored in approximately the same way that they are right now. They need to get behind the stucco and see exactly what's going on. So between now and the end of Sundance, we're going to be doing interior exploratory demolition so that there's a highly detailed plan of how this thing is going to come down and get put back together, what needs to be put back to the degree technically possible and what needs to change. So I don't expect the exterior to be changed until after Sundance.
But would we see something this winter?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like we talked before, we're pretty nervous about the roof structure and a heavy snow load or a heavy ice load and whether or not the owner would have to get up there and clear the snow and ice off of that.
So does this just go to show that demolition by neglect is a viable tool for property owners who don't want to do the rehabilitation?
This is a four-year battle or more on this particular structure. And there is a notice and order on this building. And had the new owner not stepped in and agreed to do a pretty pure reconstruction, we would have had to take some additional action against the owner to say, you got to stabilize this building and you're in violation of all these codes. So demolition by neglect is not an easy process. And it's not a viable way to get rid of historic structures. And it makes us pretty crabby.
What does this mean for the Centennial? Because they're in the same situation, aren't they?
I don't believe the Centennial has a notice on it, but I could be wrong, Leslie.
And are there any other kind of condemned structures out there just kind of waiting to fall down?
You know, the city is undertaking to stabilize two of the historic sheds up on Daly Avenue at 330 and 360 Daly. There's some really hard discussions going on about whose property they're actually on because it's old mine claims and old city right-of-way and prescriptive easements and a lot. So there was a notice and order on these two sheds just before the Daly Avenue goes to dirt up there by the detention pond. The city has actually undertaken the stabilization of those two structures, and we're in negotiation in how to resolve the situation, whether or not those two structures should be able to be moved. The HPB has agreed that can happen.
Well, I think it's also holding up development of a single-family home, yeah?
Yes, it is. Okay. And, you know, this is completely 1800s mining claim situation and trying to figure out who does what to who.
Kimball Special Event Center, is it open?
No. No. We still don't have a business license for the second floor. We understand from the applicant that they're in the process of filing for that, but we haven't seen it yet. So the second floor is not open. There are discussions about whether it'll get used for Sundance. But in the absence of a business license, we can't issue a Sundance permit. And I have also not issued the administrative permit for the outdoor deck because we have an active application and we can't process new applications until they withdraw the existing one.
Okay. Bruce, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate you.
That's Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. It's 8:41. 8:42 now, good morning. My Sustainable Year, a year-long project recently approved by the City Council, will be introduced at tomorrow's free Lunch and Learn at the PC Mark. In the studio with details, I have Park City Sustainability Manager, Celia Peterson. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Great, great. So this happens between noon and 1, again, at the Mark. What will you be sharing with attendees?
Right. So as you said, we are launching a year-long program called My Sustainable Year. And what this is all about, as you know, Park City has North America's most ambitious climate goals. And we need the community to rally around these and really... So the program is to raise awareness about climate change and how different aspects of life relate to climate change. So here's a fun fact for you. If everyone in the world lived like the average American, we'd need 5 planet Earths. So through this program, we're going to try to get our actions more in line with our community values, because we know that in Park City, people really value nature and the planet, but there's a bit of discordance about how we live our lives around. So My Sustainable Year is a program that kind of tackles one aspect of life per month. They say it takes about a month to change a habit. So we're really going to focus on different aspects of life throughout the year. And at the Lunch and Learn, I'll kind of be presenting the basics of sustainability and how it relates to your personal habits in life, and then really kind of laying out the campaign and what it's going to look like for the year.
Yeah. So how is the year broken out?
So as I said, we're going to focus on one aspect of life per month. So in January, we're going to kick off with climate change. So really a lot of information about climate change, what it's looking like at this point and how it relates to Park City. And then in February, we're going to focus on home and your home life and everything that you can do at home. In March, we'll be talking about energy and how we use energy, what the whole energy system looks like. In April, we'll be focusing on water. We know that water is a big issue in Utah, so we really want to hit that one early so people can plan for the dry summer months. In May, we'll be talking about health, how climate change and your kind of personal behaviors impact your own health and then also community health. In June, we'll be talking about transportation, how we move around. In July, we'll talk about our connection to the land, so really looking at the flora and fauna that surrounds us. In August, we'll be talking about food and food choices. September, we'll be focusing on air. October is looking at business and economy. November will be all about stuff. We'll be introducing some concepts of the circular economy, which is big in Europe. It's kind of a technical term for just basically like getting our consumption habits more in line with what goes in equals what comes out. And then December, we'll be focusing on values. So kind of the thought behind My Sustainable Years, these are all really big issues. And I think we do know what we need to do. It's just that there's so much that we need a little bit more structure around it. So I think if we just focus on one aspect per month and structure it in a way that is understandable and also kind of make it fun and really focus on building a community around all of these things. It's always easier to change habits if you've got some friends that are doing it with you. So the whole program will be really focusing on events and kind of the social aspect of things. So we've got a lot of events lined up. Of course, there will be a lot of information that you'll be able to see on the Park City's Facebook page, City Government of Park City Facebook page, and then we'll be having some talks on different radio programs, and you'll hear some PSAs throughout the year. But really, we want to bring people together and focus on social aspect of things.
Okay, so there are going to be events rather than like monthly challenges, or?
They'll be both. Okay. We're going to hit it all. This is our year to do it.
So. Okay, so again, January's mission is what?
We're focusing on climate change in January.
Okay. So what have you got planned then for this month?
Yep. First of all, the Lunch and Learn, and we'll have a lot more time to go into detail. So if you can show up today or tomorrow at noon, then please be there. On January 14th, next Monday, Rob Davies, he's a professor at the Utah State University. He'll be giving a talk called Disruption, and just the little synopsis that he's given so far sounds really exciting. That's at 6:30 at the Blair Education Center over at the hospital. I believe he's going to be talking on this group Green Earth after this program. So if you're interested in more, tune in. And then on January 16th, we're taking over the Megamind pub quiz. So there'll be a climate change themed pub quiz at Flanagan's at 7 o'clock in the basement.
Okay. So doing all this, I mean, will it really make a difference in climate change?
Well,
just our, you know, our 7,000 residents?
Yes, because we've got a lot of really big things that are lined up for this year. And yes, Park City only has 7,000-ish residents, but we do have a lot of attention and a lot of eyes on us with our ambitious goals. I mean, there's cities around the world that are watching what we're doing, because since we've got such ambitious goals and we're already doing it, we're setting example and kind of finding the pathway for other communities to follow. So we're making waves, basically. Yes, we're a small town, but we can impact others by proving that this can be done and really clearing the way for others to follow along with us.
So will you be measuring any success of this at all? I mean, and how would you do that?
Yep. First of all, participation rate is something that we can track fairly easily. And then another thing that we'll be using is we've got the platform of the SCPW Challenge that people can sign up to and really start putting their actions into that platform, which will calculate what their energy, carbon footprint savings, and also financial savings. And then it has the tools in there to help people implement the actions. So that's just one of the things in our toolbox that we can help people just figure out information that they need to make some changes at home and in their daily lives. But then also it's a tracking tool for us as well, so we can prove that we're having an impact. Because a lot of small actions, it's hard to measure those. It's hard to kind of contemplate what that adds up to. But if you use this platform, not only can you see what your own kind of good behavior is adding up to, but also community-wide what that looks like.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, just a reminder that January 14th at 6:30 at the Blair Education Center will be Dr. Rob Davies for a really kind of fun and exciting talk about climate change and what's going on in the world around us. I think he's going to relate some things to our current political climate and maybe even tell a few jokes. And then at the pub quiz on the 16th at Flanagan's at 7.
Okay. Celia, thanks.
Thanks.
It's Park City Sustainability Manager Celia Peterson. She'll be again at the PC Mark Lunch and Learn tomorrow, Wednesday at noon. This is the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:51. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, customers of Mountain Regional Water District received a letter last month telling them that their water company would be installing new water meters. In the studio with details, I have the director of the district, Scott Morrison. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, so everybody in the district gets a new water meter?
That's correct. Yeah, we're about 2 years into a 3+ year program where we're replacing all of our customer water meters. There's nearly 4,000 of them in our district.
So how come we're doing that?
Water meters typically are rated to last about 10 years, so the previous meters reach their end of life. So it's a offers an opportunity to move to more modern equipment. These new meters offer water usage information through the cellular network, and that information is provided on a daily basis. Within those daily reads, it includes hourly and in some cases sub-hourly usage information, which just offers a number of benefits over the previous water meter that was read on a monthly basis.
And so is this helpful just detecting leaks? Is that one of the big
reasons?
Exactly.
That's one of the big ones. And what's really great about these meters is it offers benefits not only to us as a district, but also to the customer. With respect to leaks, the customer can log into their water meter, log into their web page that's specific to their meter. They can set up leak alerts, where if there was continuous usage through their meter for a 24-hour period, they would receive either a text message or an email based on their preference to let them know of a leak. Through the information that's provided to us, those leaks are also, we're also notified of those, so the district can stay on top of those leaks as well. And then there are a number of benefits as well when for those customers that want to dig into a little bit more of the details of how they're using their water, for those customers that want to target, say, either a specific volume of water consumed in a month or want to target a specific bill amount, they can certainly do that. That's particularly relevant in the summer when folks are irrigating. They can adjust or modulate how they're irrigating their property to be able to hit those targets. And there's a number of other benefits as well. So
how much does this cost in the district to do?
Oh, good question. I don't have that number off the top of my head. I'd have to get that to you.
Yeah. Did you have to raise rates, though, to do it?
Nope. These are planned. You know, this is one of those district costs that's planned for.
And what do customers need to do, if anything? I mean, most of the meters are outside, yeah?
Yep, most of the meters are outside. We do have some customers that have indoor meters. That presents some challenges for us to get in there and replace those. But as far as what customers need to do, really not too much. There are essentially look for the notice that your meter's been replaced. When you receive that notice, we ask customers to go ahead and log into their new meter to have, again, that visibility and be able to take advantage of these improvements. For those customers who have older homes, one of the things that's mentioned in the notice is that we're really hopeful that customers install expansion tanks on their hot water heaters. This is part of plumbing code. This is not a Mountain Regional mandate, but it's just to protect them from overpressuring of their system. And it's not the water meter that's doing that. As part of the process of installing these meters, Mountain Regional is ensuring that there is a backflow prevention device at the meter connection, which safeguards our water system. It prevents water from the customer's residence from entering into the public water system.
Okay, so these expansion tanks do it yourself kind of deal?
For some folks, I'm sure they'd be comfortable doing it themselves. It's a very common plumbing appurtenance. If you're not comfortable, certainly any licensed plumber would be able to take care of that for you.
Okay. And is the work being done now as we speak?
It is. Yeah, we're about, like I said, we're 2+ years in. We've got, roughly half of the meters installed.
Okay. Again, you don't require those expansion tanks. You just recommend them?
It's just a recommendation. It's not a requirement.
Okay. And if people do have a water meter in their house, they need to contact you to schedule that.
That is correct. Yep, that's correct.
Okay. Anything else going on with the district you wanted to mention?
Nothing specific, just with respect to these meters. Again, we're really excited about it. It offers, leaked water is a significant concern. There's an energy component to that water. And we just want to encourage our customers to again, log in to their meter and take advantage of it.
Okay. Hey, Scott, thanks for coming in.
Okay, thanks.
Scott Morrison is the director of the Mountain Regional Water District. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.